One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging. It's often your hormones, too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, The Wellness Trap, and the new Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which are all available wherever you get your books or at ChristyHarrison.com/books. That's ChristyHarrison.com/books. And by the way, on this show, we avoid diet culture details like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome to Food Psych. Today I'm talking with journalist and friend of the pod, Virginia Soul Smith, who returns to discuss how GLP-1 hype has changed the conversation about diet culture, the importance of body autonomy, how bro diet culture became public policy, how she handles haters, parenting issues and the fed is best approach, and lots more. Behind the paywall, she shares her experience of weighing herself for the first time in many years, what it's been like to date for the first time in a larger body, how she's changed her relationship to cardio, and more. This episode is cross-posted from our other podcast, Rethinking Wellness, and you can hear the whole thing by becoming a paid subscriber at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. If you do, you'll not only get to hear extended interviews like this one and dozens of others, including many that we've cross-posted right here on Food Psych, but you'll also get subscriber-only Q&As and essays to help you think critically about wellness and diet culture and heal from disordered eating. Plus, you'll get commenting privileges and a place to connect with other listeners, and you'll be helping support the show and keeping these episodes coming. I'm so grateful to all my paid subscribers for making this work possible. And if you want to join them, just go to rethinkingwellness.substack.com or click the link in the show notes. I also wanted to let you know about my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals, which I created to help you learn how to recognize and reject diet culture, take pleasure in food and stop fighting your desires, end the restrict rebound cycle, and most importantly, I think, avoid turning intuitive eating into just another diet. When you join, you'll get instant access to hundreds of hours of supportive content, including 13 modules on the principles of intuitive eating, deep dives into how to handle common pitfalls that come up when you're trying to make peace with food, and a live monthly Q&A to help answer all your questions. This cohort also includes a special members-only forum that's running now so that you can connect with others and support each other, and alumni will get access to future forums as well. Learn more and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course or click the link in the show notes. Now, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Virginia Soul Smith. I am really excited to talk with you about your new edition of your book, and that came out earlier this year, but it's the second edition, and so I want to get into like all the ways that it's changed and sort of what you've learned since the book first came out in early 2023. First, I want to talk about life in general and how that has changed since the last time you were on the pod, since you wrote the book, right? That was published in early 2023, and this is now early to mid 2025 by the time this is coming out. So a lot has happened.
A lot has happened. Yeah. So, I mean, personally, my life evolved a lot. I got divorced. I've got two kids. I live in the Hudson Valley. Most of that was all very good change, but it was certainly consuming for a while. My day job is running Burnt Toast, the newsletter and podcast, which we have continued to evolve and grow in some cool new directions. And then, yeah, there's like this book, which is this huge part of my heart and really the cornerstone of all the work I do, which came out in April 2023, sort of right at the start of the Ozempic palooza explosion. And here we are about 2 years later. It came out in paperback earlier this year. And it does feel like, in some ways, it's still the same conversation, but we're having it in a very different landscape.
Completely. Yeah. How has Ozempic changed how you talk about this book, how people are receiving this book?
I think what Ozempic has mostly done is let people say the quiet part out loud a little more. It has allowed people who were previously at least giving lip service to the idea that we maybe should examine the goal of intentional weight loss and the goal of pursuing thinness. It has given people more space to say, no, that is what I really want. And here's the thing that's going to get me there. And I'm painting with a broad brush, obviously. I'm thinking specifically in that sense, like I see it with a lot of folks who already have a fair degree of thin privilege, who aren't living with the like really large impact of anti-fatness. I mean, of course, it impacts all of us, but they, you know, they're insulated from a lot of it. And yet this is now putting within reach like another level of thin privilege for them. And that feels exciting and understandably so in the culture that we live in that encourages us all to pursue that. I've had the unsettling experience of colleagues, people in my own life, readers, like across the board, people who I was like, oh, I thought we were having the same conversation and now you're having a very different one. And that I hear from readers as well, like that's happening a lot. Like suddenly their sister is doing it or their mom is doing it. And they were like, I thought we were kind of doing something else here. And so there's like a very disorienting quality to those experiences. I mean, on the other hand, Ozempic is a wonderful diabetes medication. So there's also lots of folks in this complicated space of this medication offers me real health benefits. It is valuable to me to be on it for those real health benefits. It may or may not also lead to body changes. What do I do with the part of my brain that is still attracted to those body changes, even though I did all this work accepting my body being larger or being at the size it was? And so I see folks really grappling with that. That's a really complicated intersection of things. I'm super proud of Fat Talk. I'm super proud of the work I've done in that space. I do think I would do some things a little bit differently if I were writing the book today to make a little more space for the folks in that messy middle space, because previously it was much easier to draw some lines around like, okay, the weight health conversation is very murky. The research isn't as clear as we certainly like the pro-obesity researchers have wanted us to think, and the weight loss industry has wanted us to think, like thin does not always equal health. You could talk about all that very straightforwardly, and a logical conclusion was, so don't pursue weight loss, it won't promote your health. And then Ozempic does complicate it because it's like, well, here's this drug that has these health benefits for folks and may also cause weight loss. We don't know that the weight loss is the reason it manages people's blood sugar. You know, that's still not clear, but like it's squishier. How do we hold together this idea that it may offer real health benefits for folks and there may also be some body changes, how to feel about all of it? It's tough. It's a lot.
It is. I recently talked to Amanda Martinez Beck for the podcast about her experience of Ozempic and how it was not the miracle weight loss drug it's billed to be for her, and yet how it's also really effective at managing diabetes. And she talked about how, like, for her, tracking blood sugar in sort of a daily way is really triggering and like wasn't something that she wanted to do and was not helpful for eating disorder recovery. So like being able to measure A1C over, you know, 3 months and then take Ozempic that had a sort of more long-term stabilizing effect where she didn't have to worry so much about the daily numbers was like really helpful for her. And, you know, that she said that she was like afraid to come out about that and like to say to her followers that she was on it because there is such kind of a black and white way that people see it. But yeah, I'm curious sort of how you've seen that play out in your space, like people who are taking these drugs for the health benefits, you know, for blood sugar management. And then also now there's like, you know, research being done by the pharmaceutical companies. So I'm not sure how much I trust it that is purporting that it has benefits for all kinds of other health conditions as well, cardiovascular disease, kidney issues and stuff, which is ironic because the warning labels for Ozempic also say that it could be associated with some kidney problems. But it's interesting and kind of squishy what actual health benefits it might have beyond blood sugar management. It's such a complicated discourse, right? Because there is sort of a desire, I think, in like fat liberation spaces to hold the line and to be like, no, this is not liberatory. This is something that's actually contributing to weight stigma, right? And like, we don't want to sort of support this. And yet at the same time, like the need to support body autonomy and people's ability to do what's right for their bodies or what they want. And, you know, for some people, there is this necessity for blood sugar management or perhaps a desire to use it for other health-related reasons or weight loss, you know, and or weight loss, right? And so it can be hard to talk about it without alienating one side or the other.
You said it exactly. It's a complicated discourse. And I feel like in Burnt Toast, you know, I work very hard to foster a lot of community discussion and supportive discourse around these things. But we've had some hard moments in the comment section where folks feel like they aren't being validated or seen because of their personal health choices. And that has been instructive for me because the fundamental thing we're all fighting for is body autonomy. And so that means everybody gets to make their own health choices, right? Like on a larger scale, that is what we're fighting for right now around reproductive justice, around trans rights. Like everybody needs to be able to make their own choices for their bodies. And I can't stand for that on some things and then be like, but not when it comes to intentional weight loss. Like, no, of course not. It's all of a piece. And at the same time, intentional weight loss can be extremely damaging when folks experience it and it triggers disordered eating or, you know, it can be a stepping stone towards eating disorders or relapse, all of that. So it is quite complicated. And I guess I feel like where I really sit with it now is I want to keep naming how anti-fatness is driving this conversation. I want to keep naming how it shows up. For example, just the fact that these drugs are getting so much more research into all of their potential health, all the other applications they may have, that's wonderful. That may lead to real tools for people managing lots of health conditions that haven't had enough tools. And if this drug didn't cause weight loss, I don't think they'd be researching it like that. Like they would not be like, oh, can we use it for this? Can we use it for that? Like, no, of course not. It's getting all of this because they've realized the power of it as a weight loss drug. And that just is a fundamental problem with it. But that doesn't mean it's not the right choice for somebody to take it to manage their health, or even that it's not the right choice for somebody to choose intentional weight loss for themselves. And that's definitely, I would say, an evolution I've had over the last few years to be able to say that. And there are certainly folks in the fat liberation community who would disagree with that. And I think there are folks who would say, I'm not going far enough. And that's kind of the road I always walk in these conversations.
Yeah, it is a tough line, right? Because there are people who want you to be very hard line about it and who need that in a way, right? I know for myself too, like I've always been in a thinner body, so I've never dealt with external weight stigma, but just to hear the messages of anti-diet, weight inclusivity, like fat liberation from people who were very clear and hard-lined about it was helpful for me in learning to relate to my own body differently, learning to practice differently as a dietitian, learning to like, you know, speak and write differently about these things as a journalist. It was helpful to have that sort of black and whiteness, I guess, in a way, in the early stages of learning about it. And then the nuances, I think, have become more important to me and to many of the people I work with as well over time as they kind of step more fully into this space, I guess.
You know, I think there's a parallel in the way I thought about parenting before I had kids and how I think about it almost 12 years into having kids. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think sometimes like just living in our bodies, living through various things, you just start to see like, yeah, we just need a lot more nuance. We just need a lot more gray space to be able to own our own choices, make our own decisions. And we can do all of that on a personal level and keep fighting against the larger oppression. and we can hold those things together. And I think it doesn't always feel that way. And I think for someone new to all this work, for someone in early stages of recovery, like, absolutely, like, be in that more firm space of dieting is never helpful. I mean, I would still stay in the space of dieting is never helpful. I think I'm going to stay there. But, you know, the intentional weight loss is never helpful. Like, that's true for, I think, the vast majority of people, that, like, specifically focusing on intentional weight loss as a goal for improving health and happiness is pretty much always going to underserve us. But having that happen as a byproduct or a side effect of managing your health in some other way, like, that's a different conversation, and we need to have space for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about the response to this book, because it's been, by all accounts, a huge success. It has really helped move the conversation about, you know, intentional weight loss and anti-fat bias and all that into the fore. What's that been like for you? And, you know, how has that changed as well since the book was first published?
I mean, I feel, like, hugely honored that I was able to contribute to this work in really any small way. It's incredible to feel like the book has, you know, that therapists use it, that teachers are finding it, that parents are finding it, the people without kids are saying it helps them work through stuff from their childhood. You know, those emails and messages are just like, I don't really have words, you know, for what that feels like to have contributed and to help people. I think for me, something that has changed, along with what we were just talking about, of, like, the increasing nuance. And to be clear, like, when I talk about that, I'm, like, almost underselling Fat Talk. Like, Fat Talk has a lot of nuance in it. It's a safe book to read, even if you're going to take Ozempic for your diabetes. Like, I don't think you'll read it and feel like I shamed you about that choice. But when I was researching the book, that wasn't the conversation we were in. So it's not, like, explicitly in there. But I think along with that piece, I've also started to realize how important it is to give people who maybe wouldn't be the target audience for this book, to give them more language around this. And in one case, so one audience I think about a lot is younger kids. I have a middle schooler now. And so thinking about how weight and food are being taught at the middle school level, even though I had a whole chapter on schools, I've interviewed lots of teachers, I hear from parents all the time about this, I was still, like, really unsettled when my kid came home and reported different assignments that they'd gotten in class about weight and health. And I was like, oh, the gym teacher is still telling them that boys can eat a full bagel and girls can only eat half a bagel.
Oh my God.
What? And, like, I live in a small town. Like, I'm kind of well known around here. Like, I just kind of thought word had gotten out. I was like, okay, we still have a lot of work to do. Not to toot my own horn, but I was like,
yeah, no, you're kind of a fixture around there. Like,
Yeah. But, like, I'm not in with the gym teachers. It's fine.
Right.
But then that made me really reflect on, like, okay, I mean, in this particular case, the gym teachers at our school district all happen to be men, and that's a whole demographic. There's a chapter on dads in the book. I have thought a lot about how men interact with diet culture and anti-fatness, but I don't think we have figured out how to directly engage men on this at all. And I don't think I'm the person to do it. Like, there needs to be, like, a male me, or I don't know.
Like a former biohacker or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. And I've been thinking about that more and more as we see RFK imploding public health, as we see Dr. Oz getting confirmed, like, this bro diet culture of, like, hacking and macros and the Huberman bro stuff, all of that, like, that is now public policy. And so the way the patriarchy has been able to profit off diet culture, use diet culture to disseminate messaging, like, all of that, oh man, we are really nowhere chipping away at that. Like, the only people who have been doing this work, painting with a broad brush, has mostly been women, non-binary, gender non-conforming folks doing this work. Like, cis men are not there. And we are seeing the real dangerous consequences of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting in this space that I'm in now, the sort of science communication, critique of wellness culture, skeptical kind of space. I've seen a lot of men in this space, male science communicators, male scientists or male doctors or whatever, doing this kind of science communication, kind of debunking. And a lot of times, with many exceptions, like people I've had on the podcast, but a lot of times the sort of approach to it in those traditionally more male dominated spaces can be very like, we're taking this down, we're debunking, this is bullshit. Like, how could you possibly believe this? You know, and I think we may have talked about this before, but like, I think that approach really feels shaming and blaming of a lot of people, and particularly women who are, and people of all genders who are attracted to alternative medicine for various reasons, oftentimes because they feel just marginalized and unserved by the conventional healthcare system, which is also very male dominated and comes from that sort of please, how could you vibe in a lot of ways. So there are like these sort of male voices in that space critiquing RFK Jr., pushing back on that stuff. But there's so much weight stigma built into that as well, like into those spaces. And a lot of the critique I see of RFK Jr. is like, well, he's right about childhood obesity, but he's just wrong about the approach. You know, there's really not a critique, especially from male voices, that comes from the place of like, we also have to talk about the underlying weight stigma here. Right. And like,
yeah. And it's just the MAHA MAGA guys. Like, it's Cory Booker, it's Bernie Sanders. Like, it's people who I otherwise really respect and align with than getting fixated on that piece. And I'm like, okay, there's more dots that need to be connected there. And I think it also speaks to how people still conceive of fat liberation as primarily a body image thing and not as a political movement. And they don't understand that this is a component of social justice work. There's a lot still more on like, well, it's just how you personally feel about your body. And so that's the needle we have to keep trying to move.
And it's interesting, too, because I'm also thinking about how like the political horseshoe has just become kind of a circle these days, right? Where there's like such a pipeline from sort of what used to be kind of radical lefty crunchy spaces into this new MAHA MAGA sort of right wing space, or there's, you know, alliances forming. And I wrote recently about like how Marianne Nessel, who identifies as very far left, has like not vocally critiqued RFK Jr. really because whatever reasons, and how problematic that is, that there are these alignments happening with like even sort of prominent academic type voices in those spaces. The social justice arguments maybe could work, maybe historically, I don't know, on the sort of lefty, crunchy type people. I don't know if in this new realigned world, if that holds as much water, because I feel like there's also a lot of critiquing of, and for me personally, I have pulled back a little bit from so much stridency around the social justice aspect of this, in part because I feel like it hasn't been effective at bridging the divide, or I'm just more concerned these days, I guess. I think everybody plays different roles, but I think my role is more of like a calm, more centered kind of centrist, maybe kind of person who can try to help bridge those divides with science. I think just in terms of like rhetorically and strategically, I think there is room for certainly like more emphasis on the social justice aspects of this for people who a lot resonate with that and who you know, would be swayed by that. But I also am like, who is that alienating actually? Or who's not going to resonate with that? And how do we reach them? Or are they reachable? Or there's just never a way to bring back the people who have gone full MAGA or MAHA, even though 10 years ago, they might have been aligned with what we're talking about now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That all resonates. And I think I'm struggling with similar, like, which ways to go with the discourse. I relate to that.
Yeah, the discourse is just, the internet is so vast. I mean, many people have said this better than I have. It really flattens the discourse so something that's meant for one audience can make its way to another totally different audience and like be completely misconstrued and used to sort of radicalize people or turn people away from an argument that might otherwise be relevant to them. You know, it's just like, it's so complicated trying to have these conversations online too.
Oh my God. Yes. It is so complicated.
Yeah. Well, sort of related to that, you know, you've written and spoken about some of the like nasty comments that you've gotten and the responses to the book that have been really negative and, you know, calling you anti-fat slurs or just like really denigrating your approach. What do you say to those critics, or how have you navigated that kind of criticism? And what would you say to someone who is just I think there's just sort of general diet culture criticism of anything that approaches fat liberation, right? This kind of like reflexive, like, oh, how could you possibly? This is abusive, or this is like, you know, you're killing people, right? I mean, I've gotten these criticisms as well.
Yeah, the like threats to call CPS because I feed my children goldfish crackers.
Oh my God.
I really hope they have more important things to do.
I really hope so. Oh my God.
I mean, the experience that I have online is both, there are times where I feel quite vulnerable because I get a lot of personal attacks and, you know, really aggressive, violent sort of messaging. And I'm also very aware of how much privilege I have insulating me. Like, for example, the goldfish cracker thing, like that came from a New York Times profile where they included a photo of my snack drawer for my kids, which does usually include like goldfish and Cheez-Its and a bunch of other foods that they like or don't even bother to eat because they ate them 3 weeks ago and now they're over it. You know, the way kids are. So that photo of my snack cabinet, like, created, like, it was a whole thing.
Wait, the lids were a thing?
Yeah, people were like, why weren't the lids on? And I was like, because if they left the lids on, you wouldn't be able to see what the food was.
Oh my God.
I don't have open containers of crackers sitting in my house. Like, what? I'm terrified of mice. Of course not. But I was very aware because people were like so angry and calling me like a horrible mother and like CPS should take her kids away. And if I was like a Black mom who'd had those photos posted, someone probably would have called CPS, right? Like, I was aware that like I was getting a tip of the iceberg of that kind of abuse because I still have like nice white lady privilege and all that. So that's what I try to keep in mind when I'm navigating those storms. I mean, the other thing about those storms is they blow up really big for like 2 weeks, and it is not great. Like, your nervous system is on high alert in those 2 weeks. It's very stressful. Like, after that piece came out, I got recognized walking my dog down my street, and I live in like a really, like, I live in the woods, like not a neighborhood with foot traffic, and like someone stopped their car to talk to me. Like, it was very unnerving, and they were friendly, but like,
yeah, it's like, what if they hadn't been?
That's... Yeah, yeah. And like when you're dealing with all that online to then suddenly have it in person is unsettling. So it's really rough in those 2 weeks and then it goes away. And what I try to keep in mind is like, usually, I don't know if we can say this every time, but most of the time when there's like the big backlash, it also means like the net is still positive. Like, I'm still netting more people entering into the conversation in good faith and suddenly finding this useful and like being introduced to these conversations. And like, I do think, you know, because Fat Liberation is a movement built by folks with many more marginalizations than me, like my role as a small fat white lady is to kind of be like the like door opener and then like come on in and go do the real work. And so like, that's something I like, I can serve as that bridge. And so that is my role. And that does mean that, you know, hopefully I am the front line for some of the negative attacks too, and other folks aren't experiencing some of that. So I don't know if it always plays out that way, but that's like, would be my hope. Let me take some of those hits. And yeah, so I try to keep that perspective in mind. I mean, some of it is just laughable. Like, there, those comments again from like the shirtless bros on TikTok, you know, okay, dude with your supplement line, like,
right.
You say what you want to say. It's fine. Like, we're just not having the same conversation. We're not going to get him back. We never had him. It's fine. So those I can laugh at. I think the harder ones are, you know, it wasn't great to have my parenting put under the microscope. Not because I actually take any of that seriously. Like, I feel very confident in my parenting. But it was really indicative to me of how anti-fatness and misogyny are woven together and how uncomfortable so many people are with a mother making choices that don't perfectly adhere to like our very, very rigid ideals about what is a good mom. And the fact that that definition of being a good mom is actually very exploitative of women and demands ridiculous amounts of labor that we shouldn't be asked to put in and isn't necessary for the health and well-being of her kids. And so the fact that I represent a different perspective where I'm like, yes, I buy processed snack foods so that I can pack lunch and like have my day run smoothly. And I don't see that as a failing.
Which is true of millions of people. And I also think there's like a classism here too, right? That like you're expected to do something different because of your social location or the expectations of other people viewing you and where their social location is versus like, you know, millions of working class and poor people, you know, and middle and upper middle class people as well, who are just like, no, processed foods help me survive. Processed foods help me get by. I mean, me too, right? I could not feed my child. I could not run my day if we didn't have processed foods and snacks around.
It's fascinating how that's something relatively small. And I think, again, like you're saying, for millions of people, that's just like, yes, how we eat and how we live our lives. And yet it is so destabilizing to see someone unapologetically doing it on a public stage. It's really interesting.
Because you're kind of supposed to apologize for it if you do it.
Right, right. Like, oh my God, I can't believe we're at the park and I only brought goldfish. And it's like, of course I only bought goldfish. I'm not going to waste $9 on blueberries that are going to get like too warm in the sun and not going to eat.
Right, exactly.
Number of strawberries my children reject because they're not like perfectly symmetrical or like a little squishy. Like, I just, right. I mean, we still buy strawberries. I feed them fruit, but like.
Yeah, but it's not something you can just bring to the park on a whim. But.
Right. Like, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to bring the, you know, the granola bars and the Chips Ahoy that I know they're going to actually eat and not reject. Yeah.
Right. Well, it also, I mean, it reminds me of the conversation around like formula versus breast and fed as best, right? I think of fed as best all the time, even though my child is three, you know, I'm just like, that's the goal here. That's what we care about. Like, she also seems to have some sort of hypoglycemia issue now. And so like, it's actually very important to make sure, but I mean, for every child, it's important to make sure that they're fed. But I've been thinking about it even more lately because of the hypoglycemia. I'm just like, okay, that is really the bottom line, and the necessity is like, how can I make sure that she eats and gets enough to sustain herself and, you know, doesn't go into a hypoglycemic meltdown?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, my oldest child is almost 12 and I still think fed is best like 3 times a week. Like, there's just so much, you know, now in middle school, like with after school activities, like she had play rehearsals till late all last week and would come home and eat like, you know, 2 frozen burritos and a plate of pancake. Like, and it was like, yeah, you're starving. You've been, and I sent food, but like, you've been going all day and fed is best. Like, eat whatever's helpful right now.
And yeah, it is so interesting how people feel the need to apologize for that or make that like a, oh, I'm such a bad mom because I let her do that or whatever. And it's like, to just be unapologetic about that and to be matter of fact about it. Like, of course she's hungry. Like, this is, you know, just the schedule and this, the fact that she wasn't able to eat during this whole time or whatever. I sent food and she didn't want it. She wanted this instead. Like, whatever. It's okay. So you've also gotten a lot of really positive feedback about the book, obviously. And we talked about that a little bit earlier, like just, you know, the onslaught of really great messages and just how incredible that feels when you know that you've touched someone's life or helped in some way. Is there any feedback you've gotten about the book that's been particularly like moving or moved the needle in some way, like a way that you've seen it used to make change in the world that has been really exciting for you?
Yeah. I mean, so we talked about like the gym teacher with the bagel comment, but on the flip side, and he obviously has not read the book yet, but hold no hope. But on the flip side, you know, at my first book event for Fat Talk, like the launch event, there was a whole row of health teachers who had come. That filled me up with so much hope that they had all come to hear and were reading the book and sharing it with colleagues. And that has sort of consistently happened. And when I did the paperback events, like the paperback tour earlier this year, same thing at both events, there were a couple of health teachers. And I just was like, okay. And doctors too, give me a lot of hope when doctors are engaging with this. But something about teachers getting it, just because like they're going to be such a key part of how kids are learning and grasping all this material. So that makes me just feel like, okay, we're doing something right. Word's getting out to the teachers. So it's super exciting. Yeah. And I was actually asked to consult on the Be Real nutrition curriculum, which just came out. It's a weight inclusive nutrition curriculum for middle school and high school. And it was really exciting to be a part of that. And there's lots of great folks who are far more brilliant than me who consulted on it, dietitians and activists and all sorts of people. But the fact that like my work was a tool that they referenced as they were developing a curriculum for kids that covers these concepts in a weight inclusive way, and that they really wanted me to go over it with a fine tooth comb and point out like any instances where they could be veering into bias and, you know, that kind of thing is really encouraging. So I think that's been the big one. I mean, I guess the other really moving stuff is when I hear from like a 12-year-old or a 17-year-old who's read the book and tells me that it's helping them, just because those ages are so vulnerable for this stuff. You know, the vast majority of interviews I do, and I know you've had this experience too, when people talk about like when, you know, when it took the hard, wrong turn for them on body stuff is usually like age 10, age 14, age 18, like those vulnerable ages. And so hearing from kids finding the work at that age is like, okay, that's great.
That is huge. So how young do you think we should start talking to kids about body size and acceptance? And what do you think is the right age to read Fat Talk with your kids or have them read it?
Well, this is a little bit of a spoiler, but I am working on a young adult version soon, hopefully, not totally ready to announce, but there is work on that. So there will hopefully be a version for kids to read on their own at some point. TBD, stay tuned. But in terms of us talking to our kids, like, it's never too early. Like, as soon as you start talking about body parts with kids, which is what, when they're like babies and you're naming body parts, like name bellies, you know, name butts, like don't be afraid of the bigger parts or those kinds of things. Use the word fat in a neutral way. It's been pretty remarkable. Obviously, my own children are just like a sample size of two, but because I did make a really conscious effort to do this their whole lives, it's very interesting to see them encounter the bias. They understand the bias exists. They report back comments that a friend said or a teacher said or whatever. But it's not penetrating for them in the way that it penetrated for me. They're just kind of like, oh my God, can you believe they said that? That's weird. And then they just like move on. And, you know, I can't say for sure it'll always be that way or that would be true for everybody. But I do think that, I mean, from a research perspective, I think we're still studying what strategies really do work to reduce anti-fat bias. There is some research showing that it's not as straightforward, not that eradicating racism is straightforward, but like there's research into like how to do anti-racist work, and we don't have the same research tested approach to what do we do about anti-fatness. We're still getting that data. But, you know, as a mom and as a journalist working on this, I think having frank, open conversations where bodies are not a taboo topic just makes sense to me. It feels similar to how I talk about genitalia in a very matter-of-fact way, because we know that, you know, when kids know the accurate names for body parts, all of that is like protective and, you know, hopefully building towards like a sex positive approach. And I think of it as very similar. Like, I just want to normalize that bodies come in different sizes, that there's no need to feel shame around any body size, that all bodies are good. You get very fundamental things. You can have that conversation very early. And then where it gets trickier is when they start interacting with anti-fatness in the world, which will happen quite early. Like, kids' cartoons often has a lot of anti-fatness. And so then that creates all these opportunities where, for better or for worse, you're going to find yourself saying, you know, what did you think of Ursula the Sea Witch when we watched The Little Mermaid the other week? You know, and one of my kids is like just a passionate Ursula fan. She has like a completely different take on the whole movie. Sees her as like a wronged woman whose kingdom was stolen from her. Triton is like, you know, it's like she's like totally down for Ursula. But like, that's really fun to explore with kids because kids are so smart and creative. And, you know, you'll help them just by being curious and asking questions. You'll see them take it in all these different directions.
I love it. You wrote a piece recently about weighing yourself for the first time in many years and how that didn't go so well. Can you share a little bit about that? Like, what was that experience like? What motivated it? And what did you learn?
Yeah, it's so funny. I'm still like, why did I do it?
That was the first half of my interview with Virginia Soul Smith. There's lots more to come, and it's really good and juicy and also so helpful to anyone who's working on healing their relationship with their body. To hear it, become a paid subscriber at rethinkingwellness.substack.com or click the link in the show notes. And if you're already a paid subscriber, look at your welcome email for instructions on how to set up your special podcast feed or hit reply and someone on my team will help you out. In the meantime, you can find Virginia and read her great newsletter, Burnt Toast, at virginiasoulsmith.substack.com and pick up her book, Fat Talk, wherever you buy books. Thanks so much to her for coming back on the show and for everything she shared. If you like this episode, I'd love for you to subscribe or follow Rethinking Wellness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Thanks for being here, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Class is now in session. And the UPS Store is here to help you ace arriving on campus. Our certified packing experts can pack everything you need, from desktops to decor. Plus, when you pack and ship with us, you get our exclusive pack and ship guarantee. Your items arrive safe or your money back. Restrictions and limitations apply. To get a 20% off packing coupon and for full details, visit theupsstore.com/packing.